OTB Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Stream live football action with a Now TV Sky Sports Pass. Your sport on your terms.
Have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner for caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course he would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course he wants to play at the weekend.
Or as he wants to play at the weekend. You're very welcome along to Golf Weekly. I am happy to say we are, as ever, here with thanks to Now TV, our good friends at Now TV, where you can stream all the sport you want. You can watch the golf. Obviously, we've got the Masters not so long away now. We've got Premier League, Serie A, EFL, and so on. It is your sport and your terms. We are very happy to have Now TV on board with us. Equally happy, if not more happy, to have Peter Lawrie from Spawell with us. Peter, hello.
Hey, Joe.
How you doing?
Very good. And yourself?
Great, good to have you with us. Nathan Murphy and Fionn Davenport have abandoned ship. Thankfully, though, that means we can replace those dead weights with somebody who knows what he's talking about. We have with us Gary Murphy, operating out of the K Club now. Gary, how are things going?
Things are going great, actually. Course is looking really well, considering all the rain and stuff we've had. But we've got a movie, that's going to come out next year, The Last Duel. They're all in situ in the hotel, so I'm coaching the crew at the weekend, so it's good fun.
Okay, so a movie has been made and the crew are all hitched up in the Cake Hotel.
Yep.
Any A-listers in there?
Just myself, Joe, that's it. loads of A-listers, yeah. No, it's great. They're good fun. Most of them are non-golfers, so it's been quite entertaining at the weekends trying to help them with their game.
Okay. Well, the COVID situation is looking very grim at the moment, so we'll see how long golf can continue. It seems to be one of the few activities that was given the go-ahead early, so we're hoping that can continue. But it's looking a bit grim, Peter, at the moment.
It's not looking great, all right. I think we can go to level 4 and still play golf. Level 5, we're going to be wiped out. But it is one of the sports that you can play as an individual and you're not close to somebody. It's a non-really touch sport, so it's amazing the amount of people who have taken it up this year. All the manufacturers are completely out of stock of beginner sets. Anybody who's looking to buy a trolley, virtually impossible to get. So it's what COVID has, if anything, has been great for golf, but bad for everything else.
Yeah. So I presume, Gary, you two had a lot of dinners down the years bitching about how terrible and how unlucky you were that day.
Mostly from Tuesday to Saturday nights, yeah. Yeah, we did. I had a bizarre experience with Peter. Peter and I played Challenge Tour, and we would have soldiered one season from probably February to maybe the end of October type of thing. And then the season would have started back up again the following February. And I remember we did the year together. We got on really well, but we didn't speak for the 3 months that we were off, which was no reflection on one another. It was just, you know, the nature of life on the road, and you have your life when you're on the road and then you have your life kind of when you're off the road. So, but no, we had some good times together. Never really fell out, I have to say, which is pretty amazing considering that we would have spent probably the guts of 12 to 14 years in close proximity. So,
just given how annoying Peter is.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make, but I'm glad you said it, Joe.
Obviously, I just, you know, just I'm like that biscuit in the side of the corner of a cup of tea. You know what I mean? You have to eat it when it's placed there.
And so, was that at the beginning of your career as Gary, or towards the end when you're trying to claw your way back on?
Oh, no, I think it was, had it been towards the end when we were trying to claw our way back on, we probably would have killed one another. But no, that would have been kind of, I turned pro maybe a couple of years before Peter. So it would have been kind of 98, 99 type of thing. Peter had a fantastic year in 99 on the Challenge Tour. I think
No, we won 2002, Murph.
Oh, I'm wrong. 2002. Yeah, there you 2002.
What about the story of Morocco when myself, yourself, and McGrain shared together? And you had just got a sponsorship with Nutri-Grain, Kellogg's Nutri-Grain.
Yeah. John Rennie.
McGrain ate all the Nutri-Grain bars for the week. You wouldn't bother having dinner. He just ate the Nutri-Grain bars. That was actually, that was my breakthrough week. I finished second in Morocco and I went from there to get my card from Johnstone.
Yeah, I don't know if I could have done 12 or 14 years sharing with Damien. That would have been, I shared with him 1 week in the Forest of Arden. It was like being on it. I was expecting David Attenborough to come out and commentate on it. It was like being in the wild. He's a unique individual, Damo.
Well, he's been causing some trouble this week. We'll come on to that. So a few things going on. Well, quite a few different bobs going on that I'm going to throw at you and get your thoughts on. First of all, it caught my eye this week. So the Shriners Hospital for Children Open is on over in Vegas and Bryson DeChambeau is there. So the driving range is 360 yards long and Bryson dented a car past the driving range. So they've had to add on an extra 40 yards to the driving range for safety. And he won there in 2018. He's going to drive multiple par fours. And in the Pro-Am, apparently he didn't hit more than a 7-iron into any par five for his second. He said, I watched Happy Gilmore a little while ago. It's re-inspired me to try and hit it as far as possible. So this is the last time we're going to see him before Augusta. He's going to take a 4-week break. What jumped out at me though was Rory McIlroy on his Instagram is following suit in some ways and was belting the ball with his driver as far as he could and showing his highest ever swing speed. So this, Gary, is clearly the Bryson effect. Others are looking at this and saying, well, we got to follow suit. Even some of Rory, who's probably never worried about distance once in his life.
I think you'll always find that with pro golfers, Joe, they're like sheep, really. You know, they kind of follow. It's normally coaches. This is unique in the sense that most guys would kind of latch on and go chasing down Chris Como and go, what have you done with this guy? I want to do that. But they almost seem to be just copying what they're seeing with Bryson. I'm astonished, really, that McIlroy has tried to get his speed up because he doesn't need to because he drives the ball so well. It would be more of someone like, you know, say Peter or someone like me when we played that weren't overly long, trying to look for those 40 yards. But when you see someone who's in the top couple of percent of accuracy and distance trying to add to it, I was surprised at that, considering that's not the part of the game that he needs to improve on, really.
Mm. Peter?
I would agree with Gary in relation to golfers are like sheep. If somebody is doing something that is, let's say, making money and doing well, we all want to know what they're doing, how they're doing it, and can I do it? So, you know, he's proven now that, which I didn't think was possible, and I have to hold up both hands and say, to get as much accuracy as he does hitting the ball that far, I didn't think was possible at that speed. But he's proved me wrong. He's proved pretty much every commentator wrong out there. And I will say we will see far more players other than McIlroy trying to increase his distance. But there again, you have to wonder, who will it destroy? Matteo Manassero came out of the blocks at 17 years of age and won Wentworth, which is on this week, BMW Championship. And he hit us with, he was quite short, but he was deadly accurate. Great putter, great short game, very young guy. And then he tried to change his whole game based around trying to hit it much further. And poor Matteo has left the scene completely. He lost his game, lost his swing, and has struggled ever since. So there is the lovely pot of gold at the end of the rainbow where, you know, if you get this distance, you might do better. But there also is the certain hazards along the way that guys will fall into, and it'll end careers.
Hmm. The thing that also was not making enough headlines about DeChambeau is just the extent to which his putting has improved. You know, that is the staggering thing. He's gone from one of the worst putters on tour in 2017 to now top 10 for the season. And Gary, you know, that's the kind of, that has been thrown at McIlroy, obviously, but even not just talking about him, I think in the game of golf at times when it comes to putting, there's almost a sense that, well, God just gives it to you or he doesn't, and you can't turn yourself into a great putter. And DeChambeau is definitely challenging that.
I think he can turn his, yeah, you're probably possibly right. He can't turn himself into a great putter. I think he can become a better putter. The big issue with DeChambeau is his method, which is borderline. I don't agree with it. I don't think it should be allowed.
You think he's still anchoring?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, he's stopping his left wrist and breaking down. So if that's not anchoring, you know, that's what we all kind of strive for when we putt. You know, everyone would like to putt like Ben Crenshaw, but no one has the confidence or the skill to swing that long and loose and roll the ball like he did. Whereas, you know, DeChambeau has it locked in his arm and he's, you know, found a way to do it even better than what Kuchar does. I think DeChambeau's a lot more upright, which allows for the left wrist not to do anything. If you think Sam Torms was probably the most famous long putter, you know, he barely had it just kind of dangling from his chin almost, you know, and whereas DeChambeau has it really anchored in. I personally think they should look at that. I don't think that method should be allowed. Because coming down the stretch on the back nine, you know, the one thing that gets affected possibly more than anything is your nerve when you're on a green. And if you can have that locked in, I think it makes it a lot easier. I'd rather see Rory trying to do a DeChambeau on the greens than with his driver.
Do you not think, though, Bryson has decided to have a method and he has stuck to this method true and true, driver and putter? And there's going to be nobody's going to make him veer away from that. I know when we played, if somebody domineered us into a way of saying, right, the structure is this, and you stick to that structure, and it will make you a better putter. Phil Kenyon has a method of putting, and has done exceptionally well with a lot of his players that he's taught. And that's why more and more players go to him, because they're looking for a structure. I feel with Rory and one or two other top players, Lou Oosthuizen could be another one, where they don't have an actual structure to their putting. It's very free and loose, as you said, a bit like Ben Crenshaw, but yeah, they possibly would be better off if they're more structured.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I just think at times there's a DNA with certain people that they're, you know, Rory, I would say, thinks about possibly nothing when he's swinging. And at times he's been hung up. And that's why he went to Bradford Faxon. He's helped him a lot with his putting. I think Rory's form since March has been more about, you know, having a baby on the way and COVID and how that's affected certain players. I think it's affected him more than most. I don't think he does very well with structure. I don't know if structure would suit him, but I think the dream for all of us as a golfer is to have one thing to do when you're trying to hit a shot, and not try to be doing two or three different things. And with DeChambeau, with the method that he has, he doesn't really have an option. He just has to kind of lock it and rock it, and that's the way he goes. But you still have nerves to deal with too, and I think it's something that hasn't been spoken enough, how, you know, we've played in Irish Opens. We've never had a home major, obviously, the guys did last year, but there's way more pressure trying to win a home open, and especially if it's a major. And to win the US Open with, you know, so much on the line, and to match it up with the US amateur, he dealt with his nerves, you know, fantastically well. And from speaking to a few guys that were there, like three under par the final day, it was just phenomenal golf. So he's got everything. He's got the power, he's got the strength, he's got faith in his own ability, and he's got a fantastic nerve when he's under the gun.
Peter, do you agree there's something questionable about his putting method?
Look, when they had the idea of changing the rules in relation to anchoring, I would have been very much on the side of the shortest club in the bag had to be the putter. But typical the RNA and the USGA, they won't go the extra mile. They seem to be very, very slow to react to any issues. Distance the golf ball's traveling, the anchoring issue. And when they do react, they react in the least possible way. Where they gave it the ability for somebody to still have an anchoring situation on a practice swing and then have it a centimeter away from their body. Bernard Langer would be one of them, when he held the putter, you know, very, very close to his chest or on his chest when practicing and then slightly moves it away. You know, is that right? Is that wrong? I personally think it's wrong. And as I said to you, the shortest club in the bag should be the putter.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's no uproar about it yet, really. We'll see where that goes. Maybe if others start imitating it. By the way, I was listening to Jordan Spieth. He was being interviewed by Colt Nost. And it's just this very interesting point. He was talking about DeChambeau and he was saying that was at the tournament in Boston a while back, himself and Justin Thomas and Rory McIlroy were having lunch and DeChambeau came up on the TV screen hitting his shots and, you know, the usual kind of DeChambeau stuff at the moment. And he said, they kind of said to each other, he has to lose the Masters before any of us can win it, which was an amazing thing for Spieth to say, especially around Augusta. And he started listing off the holes and saying, you know, like, he was, you know, different holes, different advantages. Like he was saying, take the eighth, he's going to be able to carry that bunker. That means the fairway he's aiming at is like 1,000 yards wide, you know, and particularly if the runoff, if the run and the fairways is a bit different come November, the fairways get bigger again for DeChambeau to aim at. So that was Spieth, who, no matter what form he's in, you would almost give him a chance at Augusta, saying that for any of us to win, DeChambeau has to lose, first of all, which is scary stuff if that's the feeling on tour.
I would think it's the mind game starting, Joe, to be honest.
Would you put the pressure on him?
Yeah, I think so. Why not? I mean, he's upset the apple cart for everybody, really. So why not try, you know, dig into the place where most golfers are their weakest, you know, between the ears. I would say for Augusta, if it's windy there and swirly, I think it'll negate a little bit of his advantage. If it's pretty calm and benign, that's where distance control is a hell of a lot easier to work out. But you can, I wouldn't be surprised at, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the green books and all that sort of stuff. Augusta have their own way of controlling, you know, how the player can play their golf course. So are they going to be banned that week? Are they going to think about banning them? I think undoubtedly it has to happen. It's taken away the art form. It's going to stop. You know, I would dread to think of, you know, 11, 12-year-old kids coming out with a map on the green and I hit it from A, it goes to B. And, you know, there needs to be some imagination and not from the point of view of developing golfers, but developing kids and their imagination. If everything is going to get a numbers game, it's going to take the art form away from the sport. So will we see Augusta do something around that? I'm not sure, but certainly it doesn't look good on TV. It slows the thing down. And I really do like Bryson DeChambeau. I admire him, what he has done. I think you have to have huge respect, but that is, if you look at Formula One, there's so many different rules every year. They change the rules the whole time. I think the RNA and the USGA need to be a lot more forceful with stuff like that.
Well, the odds over in Vegas, DeChambeau is the favorite. He's won here already, pre-turning into a beast. Webb Simpson's 11-1 territory. Patrick Cantlay, 16-1. Colin Morikawa, 16s. Matsuyama's there, 18s. Matthew Wolf, 22s. Who else is around? Sergio Garcia, who I want to come to, is 33-1, as is Louis Westhuizen, as is Paul Casey, and Jason Day. So that's a decent field, actually, over in Vegas this week. Yeah. So Garcia won the Sanderson Farms Championship, first win since 2017. That means, I think, he's won across two decades now and every year around the world for a decade.
Tipped up by yours truly last week, Joe.
Is that right? So tell us why. Which caddy gave you the tip this time?
Well, Bo actually told me his putting was horrific. So when a caddy tells your pro is going to have a bad week, that's the time to back the pro, because the caddies know nothing. But but no, joking aside, I think I was chatting to Porrick down here a few weeks ago, because I hadn't realized that Garcia putted won the Masters with his eyes closed.
I know, yeah.
Which was incredible. But to be honest, I think a lot of the times when you're looking at the golf, it was the weak field. Garcia was 55-1. If he turned up and played at all, he was a 15-18 shot. And it was more on the price than anything else. And then, you know, he's always thereabouts with his ball striking. He's a phenomenal ball striker. Mm-hmm. And he just found, and it just go, I think it was great to see, because it gives hope for the weekend warrior. You know, because they think these pros all the time are, they just turn up and they have their A game and they're not fiddling around the whole time, which we know in reality is not the case. For someone with the success that Garcia has had to be out there putting with his eyes closed, it just tells you that the pros struggle as much as the amateurs do. They're just better at adapting.
He said, I would love to put with my eyes open, but I just feel my stroke's more consistent when I kind of try to forget about the hole and just kind of feel it. Sometimes I feel like I have it under control and I'm like, well, let's go back to like I practice normal and it feels good. But when it comes to the tournament, it just doesn't feel quite the same way. So I would say I put with my eyes closed 75% of the time. And as you said, he did it in the Masters in 2017. Yeah. Like between the putting and like how many different putting grips has Sergio Garcia had even just in the last 2 months, let alone his career? Yeah. And between the re-gripping, you know, for this phenomenal ball striker, you know, the re-gripping the club over and over again.
He's gone back worse at that, though. He has solved it. His father solved it by wrapping tape around his hand so he couldn't move his hands. But it's got worse as the years have gone on. And I just noticed it there at the weekend. He, you know, grip, re-grip, grip, re-grip, grip, re-grip. But I have to admit, it shows how good a player he is. When he did get a chance, when he sniffed the chance of winning, he took it. The way he played the back nine on Sunday was superb. You know, his ego on 15, was it?
14,
You know, pardon me?
I think it was, 14, I think.
14.
Yeah.
You know, set him up. Look, he's a fantastic golfer.
You talk about re-gripping. I played with him in Dubai 1 year. I was really unlucky because McGrain was behind me playing with Tiger. And I got bloody Sergio. But Damien, remember he had Tiger for that weekend in Dubai? God, I was so jealous. But the first 8 holes, that round I played with Garcia, he used 4 different grips the first 8 holes. So he was, that was kind of, I think, I can't remember what year it was, probably 07 or 08. He was... You know, so he's been battling this for a long, long time. Yeah. As Peter says, it just shows his class to when he had it, you know, because loads of players, myself included, have had loads of chances to win, but I didn't get to win. Obviously, Peter did. I'd get that in there before he does. But, you know, it's the fact that you take the wins. You know, loads of players get chances every year. But Garcia, still, even with the, you know, battling what he is, he still took his chance, and it just shows. I think he's over 10 wins on both tours and a major championship. There's only about 6 players have done that. So, you know, he's...
I was amazed by that list. Did you see that list?
Yeah.
Of the players who have won 10 times on both tours. Greg Norman, Tiger Woods, Ernie Els, Adam Scott, Sergio Garcia, and Rory McIlroy. That's it.
Wow. You know, exalt a company.
Yeah.
What's he like to play with, Gary? Because he'd leave people feeling a bit cold in some ways. There's a petulance to him sometimes, or a self-centeredness to him sometimes, to be honest.
Yeah, there is. It's a bit of the Mick McCarthy, Roy Keane, because obviously he had a showdown with Harrington. So everyone on this island's going to shout for Paddy over Garcia. But he was... He was fine. It was funny, actually, the first hole we played, because the place was like a zoo, because McGrain and Tiger, more so Tiger, were in the game behind. But So it was just like a zoo, and I was quite nervous, and it was my honor. And I had played with him about 6 or 7 years previous when he was just a kid, but I was quite nervous playing, but I was really excited to see what how his game had improved, and especially his ball striking. And I hit it up the middle on the first, and then he hits this horrific block way right into the Munchies, well, heavy rough, and then proceeded to hit that about 25 yards right of the green. I hit a lovely second shot to about 12 feet, and he holds the pitch. So I'm there looking at his ball striking, and he was all over the place the first hole. But no, he was good to play with. He was fine. He was very professional. He's courteous to you if you played well, and he was quite chatty. And I've kind of always been a fan of Sergio's. I think his behavior has been questionable a couple of times. I think he does get in his own way a little bit, but that's his nature. You know, he's Spanish, he's emotional. You kind of, I think it's a little unfair to be too critical about him, but he has been a little bit petulant. But you see that too with John Ram. I think it's just the Spanish blood coming through, really. But an amazing player. Like that list that Peter read out there, I mean, it's a who's who of modern day golf.
And so give us a sense of the ball striking, because unfortunately, well, shot tracer to an extent helps, but it's really hard to appreciate or differentiate on TV, you know?
Well, I actually changed the shafts of my clubs after I played with Garcia, because I was a decent ball striker, but I was more of a swinger. I didn't really crush it or compress it. And I was using rifle shaft 6.5s. And as I was walking around, I had a look at Sergio's clubs, and he had the same shafts. And I was kind of going, well, you know, why am I using the same shafts as him? And he, you know, he covers the ball a lot better than I did at the time. So I actually went back to a 6.0 and it helped my game. And it is something I think players do use shafts a lot that are too stiff for them. and they try challenging themselves rather than having the proper shaft in their hand. But he was an awesome ball striker. Just very much a left to right player with his driver, but could move it easily both ways with his irons.
He probably was one of the best drivers on tour, though.
Yeah.
One of the straightest drivers.
Yeah.
Himself and Lee Westwood would have topped the rankings in accuracy for a long time.
Yeah.
He was a brilliant, brilliant ball striker off the tee. Irons were okay, but his short game was superb, apart from putting when. But he could put... I played with him... I played against him, should I say, as a kid in the European Amateurs in Port Marnock. And he put it so well then as a young guy.
Yeah.
Like, he putted me off the golf course. He beat me on 17, I remember. And, you know, when he came out early, his putting was superb. It's over the last couple of years where he has struggled a little bit with more nervousness than anything, I would have said.
Well, I think it must be scar tissue to a degree, and you think of the way he lost the Open to Harrington in 07. That stuff is painful, and that is nervousness as well. And I was going to make the point between the regripping, even him being consummate ball striker, but the regripping there and then the woes on the green, like there's a lot going on in that head. There are a lot of demons there that he's having to conquer, I would say, to play. And it is to his credit that he keeps going, because it would be very easy to get a bit frayed and not want to do this for much longer.
It is, and you also look as well that last week was a small event in the scheme of things, but it just goes to show how important winning is. I think we're probably a little guilty at times of overplaying the majors and the big events, but you know, winning is winning. And if you look towards the Masters in the month's time, it's a bigger issue for guys that haven't won this year to win at Augusta, whereas Sergio will be going back in there, even though it's at Sanderson's Farms, a smaller event. He's going back to somewhere where he's won. He has won in within a month of that tournament. So he's putting with his eyes closed. It's working. You know, is Garcia someone to really look out for at Augusta, because he has that win under his belt?
Have either of you tried putting with your eyes closed?
Not in competition.
No.
In practice, yes.
Couldn't even imagine.
It's a good thing to do. I think I've practiced it. I used to have a tendency a lot of being quite conscious of my stroke. And I get caught at times looking at my backstroke. I think that's one of the main benefits of it. You don't, you know, your eyes obviously stay where they're supposed to stay, because they're not looking at anything. So, and I think once you have a little tiny little eye movement, it affects your shoulder, your head and your shoulders, and that can get your stroke out of line too. So if it takes a lot of practice though, I wouldn't recommend deciding on the first grain on Saturday morning to have a crack.
I've recommended to a few people to look at their left hand. Are there, you know, the left thumb or something like that, to take their focus off the ball and to take the focus off the swing. But never have I told anybody to close their eyes and hit it.
But if I look at my left hand and my left hand is rocking backwards and forwards, am I not, my eyes not all over the place then?
No, well, not really. It just takes your focus off the actual club head, which is moving a whole lot more than your hands are.
Okay. Hey, listen. Whatever
the putt's from.
Yeah, it's the most personal of all the strokes, I guess, isn't it? It's literally whatever works for you, however funny or daft it is.
It is. I think the most important thing on greens is your speed. You know, people get way too hung up on reading greens. I think, you know, because the read is completely dependent on the speed. And if you concentrate, you know, just trust the line, pick a line. It doesn't matter what it is. It's better to try hit your line than try to hold putts, because, you know, you can hit a fantastic putt and hit your line, it doesn't go in. But it's, if you get a better feel for the speed, you'll have a better tendency to get yourself in around the hole. And especially for guys that struggle, you know, you get players that struggle with three putting a lot. 90% of the time, it's their speed what's holding the read.
I find the most frustrating thing to do, and I will do it once around, is from somewhere about 4 or 5 feet out, we'll see the break, we'll allow for the break, but then we'll hit it at a pace as if I was going to hit it through the break. And there's nothing more stupid than that.
I know, but it's you're reading the putt for the speed, Joe, not for the break.
Mm. Yeah. Well, sometimes though, I think, well, I'll just rifle it straight through the break at the putt for, you know, a short one. I'm talking a short one here.
Yeah.
But then it's when you hit it at that kind of pace, but you're allowing for the break and it just rolls 4 feet by.
Yeah, good thing on the short one is just look at the ball and then look at the back of the hole for 5 seconds, back to the ball and just beat it at the back of the hole.
Would you do that just and say, almost hit it through the break from that kind of pace?
Yeah, I did that a lot as an amateur. I was a much better putter as an amateur than I was as a pro, because I had a bizarre technique. I used to take it back with my left hand through my right, depending on the break. And I put it fantastically as a kid. And then I went to college in America and some numpty told me that I had to use my shoulders. And then the bigger numpty listened to him. And unfortunately, it didn't help me putting.
Oh dear. We'll get him on the line sometimes. We'll have a reunion and we can talk about it. So Wentworth, Lowry is there. Harrington is there. G-Mac is there. Larry's obviously off the back of a 9-week stint on the PGA Tour, played Gorham Castle, utterly wrecked. But he's back now at Wentworth, has taken a little break and has a brilliant record there, as we know. So in the last 7 years, he has only once finished below 12th. And obviously there was that time with McIlroy in 2014, bunch of top 10s. So he's there. And then the Mad Hatter himself, Harrington, shows up at Scotland. Almost misses the cut, but for like an insane sand save, ball above his feet, and you know, stitches it to what, a foot, and then has a top 10. So I mean, if you can analyze that, man, good luck to you. I can't make sense of him.
Peter, you can go first in this one.
Yeah, look, we all know Porrick is Porrick. He actually got lucky enough on the Saturday morning. He got out, you know, before the horrible conditions, and got himself up the leaderboard, which really, really helped. And then Sunday, he just knuckled down and played really, really good golf in tough conditions. So, but that's, Porrick is used to playing in bad conditions.
Mm.
It's funny enough, it's amazing to hear the guys whinge on about playing in bad conditions. And as us pros, we kind of get a little bit spoiled in a way, because the tournaments follow the sun and we don't really play in bad weather. And then when we have to play in bad weather, then it's like a shock to the system. While amateurs in general, they play in bad conditions 80% of the time. And then 20% of the time, they have the short sleeves on and the shorts. And then they can't play at all because they can't understand, I've got so much freedom. It works reverse for the pros. So you get a couple of guys who can play in bad conditions my namesake, Paul Lowry, was brilliant at it. Every time he put on a jacket, he'd play great golf. Every time the jacket was off, he'd struggle a little bit. It was just his kind of comfort zone. And Porrick is a little bit like that. He'll play, and it won't bother him to play in crappy conditions and be able to hit different shots and chip and putt and chip and putt. And that's what he's been pretty much doing for the last 6 months, is chipping and putting in the back garden. So it's good for his confidence, to be honest with you, to finish, you know, a top 10. Or he finished top 10, didn't he?
Yeah, tight ninth.
So, which is great for his confidence, and especially coming into Wentworth, where religiously he hated Wentworth because of the greens. But it's a different time of year. It's nearly the match play time of year, when they used to play the match play event in Wentworth, and he likes Wentworth this time of year. So you just can't count him out on these greens in this golf course at this time of year.
And in what way will the greens be different now, Peter?
The greens are Gary might know, are they Poana? And in the summertime, if you're out first thing in the morning, they're brilliant. But as the day goes on, the actual leaf starts to grow a little bit, and they get kind of heel marky, and the ball bounces around the place, and they're really fast, and they're really bumpy, and they scared the living daylights out of you. And Porrick used to hate this, used to drive him mad. But later on in the year, they don't leaf at all during the day. They're cut tight, they're softer, so they're not as quick. And they stay much truer.
Okay. Jeez, he must see, well, he deals with lots of Poana in the States. If he hates it, he's done well over his career to stick with it. Did you like Wentworth, Gary? What's it like to play?
It's fantastic. I absolutely love the course. I only really had 1 year where I kind of had a chance, and I eagled the 12th in the final round, and unfortunately completely shit the bed coming in the last six holes. It's a brilliant week. It's going to be very different for the guys this week with no crowds. But normally, I don't know whether it's been Irish, but when you played a European Tour event in the UK, it just had an extra spice to it, a bit like playing an Irish Open. You've very knowledgeable crowds, brilliant atmosphere. The only thing, it was always a gripe for the tour players when you went there, because on the Tuesdays and Wednesdays, it's a really small range at Wentworth, and it was always a zoo, because you had every agent or every part of the players' team seemed to be on that range, and there was never any room to do anything. So, and I played with Shane on Monday night, and he was just saying that the early parts of the week now are way better on tour, because it's much calmer. And it's really enjoyable. There's not as many hangers on and that kind of stuff. But he was saying that the tournaments itself, that they're just terrible with, because it's just void of atmosphere. Mm. But yeah, it'll be different for the guys this week, because that atmosphere won't be there. And it's a special atmosphere. You know, the British galleries are brilliant. They're lads drinking a few pints, having a bit of crack, the fish and chips. And, you know, and we grew up watching, you know, that was the only golf we really saw when we were kids growing up. So obviously the younger generation of our saturation point with golf, but I always felt, and when I played in the UK, it just felt a little bit better and a little bit different.
You mentioned knowledgeable crowds there. I would imagine it's such a nice thing to play in front of a knowledgeable crowd who are tuned in to what you're doing.
Oh, it's huge. It really is, because I never played on the PGA Tour, but just from watching it, you know, a lot of the time there's just screaming and bawling because guys want to get their voice out there. But they really do. You know, you can hit, let's say an example, on the third hole in Wentworth, which is probably one of the hardest holes in the course, you know, you hit it in there to 40 or 50 feet and you'll get a really good round of applause, because they appreciate that's a proper golf shot. And just stuff like that. And you can get a good feed and indication from the crowd. And we all know, you know, playing sport in front of a crowd is the best thing you can do. It's the easiest way to play. I really feel for some of the rookies on tour now, Joe, who were, you know, even playing this week and not getting to experience, you know, and you saw it last week, such a huge event. You know, the Scottish Open is a historic event on the calendar. they were finally playing for some, you know, heavy money, and just nobody out there watching them.
But Wentworth was always one, no matter what group you were in, there was somebody there to watch it. You know, yeah, and they'd be, could be five or six deep. Yeah. Because people, Wentworth's like a bit like the Masters. People come along and they're local, they drive in, they park their bench and their seat and their cups of tea and whatever else on the side of the green, and they watch the whole groups coming through. And and they'll be able to know what's a good shot, what's a bad shot, if such and such missed it right, or, you know, always going to miss it right here because nobody sees this break. It was always a fantastic week. And unlike Murph, I used to love the range on a Wednesday or a Tuesday, because you used to talk to everybody. You used to get all the information. I used to suck all the information out of everybody.
When you say information, you mean gossip.
Gossip, absolutely. Used to love the gossip. And also, all the manufacturers used to bring out most of their new stuff at Wentworth. I don't know whether, remember this one, Murph? This guy turned up on the putting green. You used to have all these new putters arrive in Wentworth. They might be in their testing phases or you know, prototypes or whatever else. Remember the glass putter?
Yes.
So this guy came out with a glass putter. And he had maybe 10, 15 of them. He had them approved through the R&A. Did you use one that week, Gary?
I used one in 03 for that season, and because I used it a few weeks later in Loch Lomond, which was my biggest finish, or not biggest finish, but biggest check on tour. And I had a great season, made it to the tour championship at the end of the year, and it cracked on my honeymoon.
Wow.
So it's all Elaine's fault, nothing to do with me.
But as I said to you, Joe, these things, they come out and they're never seen anywhere else. So you get your first chance to see everything at Wentworth. Mm-hmm. And then after that, then they might be mass produced or whatever. But it was always something special.
But that also, Wentworth, because it was played in May, so that would have been our first kind of major, you know, the biggest prize fund of the season. That added pressure, you know, if you can have a good week. And that week also ended a lot of player caddy relationships. Because guys, you'd have the different standards, like guys trying to keep their card. If they got to Wentworth and had a bad week, you'd get rid of your caddy because I need a fresh start for the second half of the year. Or guys that weren't doing so well. So Wentworth was kind of a yardstick almost for where your season was at. And you could change. I mean, I remember Simon Cann came out of tour school and won Wentworth. So, there was a lot of players that won that tournament.
Yeah.
Remember Andrew Alcorn winning it, Anders Scott Hansen, Drummond. Scott Drummond, yeah, came from nowhere to win it, beat Cabrera down the stretch shooting about 19 under par.
Yeah.
So it was a huge week. But as Peter was saying, it's now kind of back to that World Match Play date, which we all would have all grown up seeing that tournament. So, and the course will play a lot differently this week.
Mm. You mentioned you played with Shane on Monday without wanting to break any confidence. How's he feeling about things? It seemed like he was pretty happy to get home, to say the least.
Yeah, you were saying he was 9 weeks on the road. I think he's been kind of 8 months on the road, really. He's been there since February. And his wife and daughter came back, I think, early July.
Okay.
And I think just from chatting to him, he was just missing playing golf. He was probably working, doing a lot more in the gym, practicing a lot more than what he normally does because he just had so much downtime. And then he wasn't coming back and having his normal switch off of just, you know, going down home to see a Gaelic match, see his mum and dad and his family, and just a normal kind of switch away from golf. So it's been since February, just golf, 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 and he's had no downtime. And he was really disappointed with Gal Gorm because he was trying to do hard there, trying to make up for not doing as well as he wanted in the States and trying to get the Irish Open to repair a bit of that damage. But he was just saying he struggled so badly with what we were chatting about earlier with the air. Like they really struggled how far the ball was going. He couldn't believe how short how long it was playing compared to what he'd been used to in the States. And they just, he got in there Wednesday and he just didn't really have time to recalibrate and get done. And then he was trying too hard. And I think he struggled in Irish Opens really because of that. And Galgorm was no different. But I played with him on Monday night. We played 9 holes around the back down the Keg Club. And unfortunately, he wanted to play off the blues, so I had to play off the blues. His game's awesome. Like, it's just beautiful. Played with half a set, shot 2 under par, not even trying. If he'd hold a few putts, he would have been 6 or 7 under par. It was, he was in second gear, Joe, and I was burning diesel in fifth gear and still couldn't get near him, so.
And you won the money down, Murph, did you?
No, I didn't, no.
I guess you've seen him close up for a long time. How would you compare like his game kind of post 09 when he's turning pro that first year or two with what it's like now?
His game now compared to then is probably the same as mine then compared to now. I mean, he has improved so much. He's so much stronger. He's so much fitter. He's just got gears in his game now, which he didn't have. Like, there was a couple of, and it's only a relaxed environment, but you really see how good these guys are when you play with them in that relaxed environment. And he can just, you know, he was hitting it probably 25 past me, and then we went down the last, and he hit it 40 past me. So okay. he's got gears to his game. He's really, really good control of distance, even when he's trying to hit it flat out. Which is the hardest thing to do, and I was super impressed. I hadn't played with Shane for about 2 years, and his game is awesome. It's just trying it. Listen, it's golf. You don't know when it's going to turn up, and it's a difficult sport. But his game, I was, and Bo had said it to me. He said you'll be really impressed because Bo just thinks he's so good, and he's worked for a lot of good players, but. His game is phenomenal.
Okay. Well, I mean, geez, it wouldn't be a bad time to get hot for the next couple of months. What, it's 6 majors, you know? Someone could do very well here, you know, and define their career over the next while. Just on the Irish Open then. So Damien McGrain speaks his mind at the best of times, I think, Damien. So he was talking to, I intended to say this is controversial. I don't think this is controversial, by the way. But he was talking to Greg Allen on RTE after the Irish Open. And he played in it. He said, the golden question must be how come the Irish Open last week was a miserable affair for Irish golfers. Miserable. And it's disappointing. Our flagship event. I know we've all had our challenges with COVID, but the Irish Open's meant to be a celebration of Irish golf. I probably shouldn't have even been there myself. I was feeling guilty about taking a spot. When I went up there and realized how weak the field was, though, I quickly got over the fact I wasn't robbing anybody of a spot because the field was weak anyway. So I wasn't doing any tour member an injustice because it probably slid into the Challenge Tour rankings. Yeah, the company was good, but unfortunately the depth is not there anymore. The depth is not there anymore, talking about Irish golf. The new men are struggling still to find their feet, struggling to establish themselves on tour, and then the vacuum falls in behind them. But for 3 amateurs to be brought into the field because we don't have 3 pros really of good enough quality to make up those 3 spots, I found it to be a sad day for Irish golf. It was a lonely experience last week with so few Irish players about. Like, an Irish Open is about Irish players featuring, possibly bettering themselves, maybe making a future. But last week, there was hardly any fat in the bones. There's a kink in the system somewhere. There's a kink in the system somewhere from leading amateur to a leading tour pro. The few guys who have made it, and made it big. But there are too many guys falling by the wayside. I believe that our leading players need to embrace them more, need to help them more, nurture them and nurse them along. There are a lot of guys getting caught in the quicksand and they disappear. And these are good players. Thoughts?
Who wants to go first? I'll go first on this one to say Murph's blushes. look, Damien is a character where, yeah, you're right, he speaks his mind. But to be fair, you need to listen to him most of the time. You know, you can pick out one or two things that he probably goes on with, and he probably goes off on a bit of a tangent sometimes in relation to the 3 amateurs that were in the field, deserved to be in the field. We had some serious amateurs there. one had won the British Amateur. So absolutely deserves to be in the field.
Well, if James Subaru was at the US, he can play at Galgorm Castle, I think.
And totally deserves to be in the field. In relation to when he talks about there's a gap there. There is a gap there, and there always has been a gap between your top amateur and your being successful as a professional. And people do get caught in that vacuum and get sucked into quicksand, as they say. When I turned pro, I gave myself 5 years. That was my master plan. And only on the fifth year did I make it. Did I crawl out of this, you know, playing mini tours around the world, playing Challenge Tour, playing Euro Pro, playing all these different things to try and get onto the tour. And I was lucky enough to be funded by Team Ireland and the Irish Sports Council and whatever else. So it wasn't, I'm not saying money was an issue, but you had to fight for every penny that you got, and then you had to fight not to spend any penny, you know what I mean, going forward. But it was tough mentally more than anything else. And you did need support. And I was lucky enough, I got support and I got help. You know, I was able to phone up Porrick or Gary at the time, who was just ahead of me, and seek advice and you know, get that little bit of help. I feel that when they leave the amateur ranks, they nearly know it all, but they know nothing. And they nearly know too much to ask the right questions to get the right answers.
Peter, how many pros in the last, young pros in the last 5 years have phoned you up for advice?
Maybe one or two have come to me, but in general, very, very few.
I think that's a big issue as well.
And to be honest with you, Gary, I have put it out there many times. If anybody wants to phone me up and have a cup of tea and meet with me, no problem. I'd be delighted to help. You know, I reached out to, and I'm not breaking any confidence here, I reached out to Paul Dunn when he was heading off to tour school only recently. Sorry, I reached out to him when he was going to play his last tournament in Australia to try and keep his card. And I was told, I'm grand, thanks. But I'd been there, I'd done it, I'd known what it's like. God, I put myself through torture. I remember flying down to Australia. I had Ronnie Corbett on the bag, which was probably a mistake. But I needed to finish top 20 to keep my card. And I remember being in the hotel room most nights and I'd just be in absolute floods of tears, because I wasn't able for the pressure. You know, I wasn't, and I'd been on tour for whatever, 13 years at the time.
Yeah.
But I knew there was something disappearing, you know what I mean? And support other than family, that was it. But these guys need support. These guys need more than you know, 100 euros in their back pocket or a couple of grand in their back pocket. They need to be shown the way.
I think the problem with it is that we've had probably five or six pros in the last few years that have, you know, had really good amateur careers. And it needs to be said too, there's a lot of kids turning pro that shouldn't be turning pro. They're just not good enough and they'll never be good enough. And some of them have access to funds, which makes them think that they're going to make it, and they're just not going to make it. And I think there needs to be a little more collective responsibility. And I remember chatting to Pat Finn about this, who's recently stepping down as the CEO of the GUI. And Pat made a point to me that I completely agree with. You get some kids coming through and they'll win, for argument's sake, the South and the East and maybe the Irish Amateur for 1 year, and off they go to tour school, they're going to be a pro. And it's the guys that are winning year on, year out for two or three or maybe 4 years as an amateur. I know they're turning pro a lot younger, but it's the guys that are dominating are the ones that, when they actually do turn pro, are more successful. That's why I think the American system is better. Go to college for 4 years in the States. Number one, get your degree, but play against the best players in the world. As we saw Carton House in 2018, you know, at the Eisenhower, the World Amateur Championship, look at the players that have come out of that. I think we've had 8 or 9 tournament wins. We've had Morikawa win a major from that field. So that's the elite level. But I think it's different now. When we were turning pro, we had fortunate enough to have maybe 3 or 4 years as an amateur at the top level and then decide. But there's a lot of them doing it too quickly now. But the problem is they sign with the management company, and there's no real management companies that have any proper interest in these players, you know, and they just get absolutely thrown to the wolves straight away. A lot of them, and we've seen some good players. Like, it's not that long ago, we had 5 guys in the Walker Cup team. And there's not, off the top of my head, there's what, Paul Dunn, Jack Hume, Gary Hurley, Cormac Jarvan, Gavin Moynan. So that's 5 years ago. There's not one of them with full status now on the European Tour. So that's 5 years later. Now, Paul Dunn has won a tournament in unbelievable fashion to hose down Rory McIlroy to win the British Masters, which was a huge event. But of those 5 players, none of them have really soldiered on. I know Paul has been unlucky with injuries, but when Gavin Moynan, hugely talented, they're all hugely talented. Jack Hume doesn't play anymore. You know, but Gary Hurley, hugely talented. So there's something, the kind of same thing seems to be happening to all of them. And are the GUI looking after them too well? Are they too pampered? Do they not have a skin on them when they turn pro? That's possibly the case. But I think the big problem is the management company, where it's the glamour of signing with, not to name any companies, because that's unfair to do that, but to sign with certain companies, and they're all mad keen on getting a contract here, getting a contract there, rather than, you know, I need to improve my game. I need to keep doing what I'm doing, but I need to improve my game. And I think they get hung up on that. And I've probably, the same as Peter, I've had very few young pros, you know, call me for advice. And it's not that I have all the answers, which I certainly don't, but at least I've been there and I've kind of lived it, and I can see a lot of the pitfalls. And I remember I was down in Mount Wolseley a couple of years ago, the Challenger event, and just 3 or 4 of them running around like absolute headless chickens. And the thing to understand as well, like, there is a golfing class between being a top amateur and being on the Euro Pro Tour. And there's a golfing class between the Euro Pro and the Challenge Tour, and the Challenge Tour and the Main Tour. So it is a stepping stone. And Peter was 100% right in giving himself a 5-year plan. But when Peter had that 5-year plan, he was still improving every year, you know, and with a crescendo of winning the Tour Championship on the Challenge Tour and going on to the Tour and finishing 57th, I think, his first full year on tour. So that's serious progression. But we're not seeing that progression from the players coming through. Team Ireland do a fantastic job, as they did when Peter and I were coming through. But they're funding these kids. There needs to be a lot more supports in place from a management side. But who wants to pick up the baton? No one, nobody does at the moment. I tried it a little bit. That's a very difficult space. And I really feel for these kids at the moment, because with COVID, that space has been made even more difficult from a sponsorship point of view. I think Damien was a little harsh in what he said, because historically at an Irish Open, kids have had a good season, you know, or have shown some form to get an invite, and they're moving into an Irish Open with a bit of confidence, where that wasn't really the case this year. You know, Cormac did really well last year. Robin Dawson did really well last year in Lahinch at a proper Irish Open with the packed house playing for €7 million or dollars. And they performed well. But Cormac hasn't soldiered on this year. He's got a full card. Robin Dawson has been unlucky in the sense Challenge Tour has been a non-event this year. So it's a tough space for them. But there's a gap there between when they turn pro and how they find their feet. And there's a big scrappy.
Final word, Peter, on that?
The big thing is, if there's any young guys out there listening to this podcast, right? And hopefully there is. And they have dreams about turning pro and playing on tour. Until you can dominate the Irish region, Irish close, south, whatever it is, and go play British amateur and stuff like that, then don't even think about turning pro. Don't even think about it, because you're not good enough. And even then, when you can dominate these things, these tournaments, then and only then do you have a chance. But you, it doesn't guarantee you only have a chance. Professional golf, like anything, you have to be exceptionally, you have to be lucky in a way. My first year that I came out, I got beaten in a playoff for the Spanish Open, which immediately I earned enough money to keep my card. So there was no pressure on me then for the rest of the year. I could learn, I could go through it, I could, and then the following year, it's all about keeping your card and staying out there. It's nearly harder to get out there than to lose your card, if you know what I mean, because you have so many opportunities. The young guys coming up now have very limited opportunities to get a tour card, and for that tour card to be any good. It's amazing to see the celebrations for guys who get a tour card or go to tour school and get a tour card. And it's useless. They might as well have the winning lottery numbers, but one number missing.
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee them any. It doesn't guarantee them any tournaments. And the way the European Tour is going now, and I know you had this discussion last week with who was on last week, the Telegraph?
James Corrigan.
And he made a very good point. The European Tour is going to be swallowed up by this new group, for sure. Absolutely, 100%. And it's actually not Saudi money. It's actually an American fund is going to take it over. And there'll be fewer and fewer chances for the young guys now to come on and play. They're going to be playing for minimal amounts of money into smaller tournaments and stuff like that. To be fair, and Gary, myself, Damien, we got very lucky for when we played, for the standard that we were at, to make a few quid out of it and to get out while the going was good. The tour is going to have to regroup again and nearly start over because of what has happened.
I think it's a really tough space for these guys, and it's important as well not to see age as a deterrent. Like, these guys are, they're fit, they're strong. You know, the new, you know, a guy can stay in his 30s, get out on tour and do well and have a good 10 years out of it. Don't think just because you're 24 or 25 that you're too old. You know, and my advice would be to some of our top amateurs, and there's one guy in particular, Keelan Rafferty, who's a fantastic player, and I feel for him because he was an absolute standout last year and was kind of, you know, ready to go turn pro. He's producing, shooting some really low numbers, which is always a good sign. I would never get too hung up on guys winning match play events, but he's putting low numbers up, and he's just a no man's land this year. You know, but it doesn't matter. He's gone to Maynooth. He's got educated. That's the most important thing, first and foremost. But, you know, try just... see it as an opportunity. Don't see it as, oh my God, you know, there's nothing for me next year. Go out and try dominate the amateur scene and take it from there and look forward. But if you truly believe in yourself, the place to go is the States. You know, okay. if that means you have to get on a mini tour and work your way up, we all have to do that. But that is the place to go.
Well, look, Gary, I'm 35 and I've just got down to single figures. I'm going to call you after this and we might try and map out the next 10 years. I believe in myself. No one has the belief in themselves that I have.
Just be Gary, all I can say is when the phone rings and he's looking for a lad, delete it. Then delete the number.
Peter Lorry almost set me back 2 years in a 15-minute lesson. That's all I want to say about that.
He doesn't take advice very well, Gary.
Peter couldn't teach a dog how to bark.
I can vouch for that. So before we wrap up, I should just mention the KPMG PGA Women's Major on this week. Yes. So I presume Sky will be carrying that. And increasingly, I'm preferring to watch the women golfers. Mel Reid won on the PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour. last week. So this seems like it's going to be interesting because they're following suit in terms of distance. It's a beast, said Reed, of the course they're playing. Probably the toughest golf course I've played. If the guys were playing it here, it would be the equivalent of 10,000 yards. Christy Kerr said, we're calling it the lumber yard right now because of the amount of woods that we'll be playing. Danielle Kang said, monstrous. And Imbi Park said, she won't be reaching certainly two of the par fours if the wind is up in two shots. She won't reach them in two. So it seems like they're saying to the women, get longer. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see if it plays out that way.
Yeah, I think it's the wrong way to go for women's golf. If you look at their last major, it was sensational viewing on the Sunday night. I mean, their game is built on accuracy. I wouldn't agree with setting up a course like that. You're knocking out 80% of the field straight away. I mean, if Lexi Thompson is not a better round there, I don't know what is. You know, it's and that's unfair because a major should be there to challenge everyone and not just the select percentile of the field. But I agree with you, Joe. The women's golf has been sensational the last few weeks. And Leona's shown some good form. I know it's a huge step up in class. And she wouldn't be the longest on the women's tour, so it's not going to play into her hands. But to have three women make the cut in the last major, three Irish women rather, was amazing. Because, you know, there's young kids, young boys playing golf because of Rory McIlroy's and Shane Lowry's. And we want to get a lot more girls into the game. And for the weekend warrior, watch the women's game. You'll learn a lot more about how to swing club than you will watching Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah, for sure. The one quick thing I wanted to mention before we go, Peter, I know you were in touch. You wanted to give this a quick mention. I mean, there's not so much we can say about it. It's just to let people know because it's interesting if they hadn't seen it. So Tony Finau, he's having a tough time, COVID, and now he's been sued for $16 million. So this has been lodged in a court in Utah by a former business associate called Maloney High, who owns a company called Icon Sports. Basically, they provided financial support to Finau and his family for a number of years when obviously they were, you know, poor background and he was trying to make it. So him and his brother, Gipper, they gave it to his father, Gary, and the expenses totaled $592,000. And now Holla, the guy who's suing them, wants $16 million back plus interest because they say that represents 20% of the lad's career earnings, which is what he says was agreed. So he helped out the family with the mortgage, the medical insurance, new car, living expenses for the Finau family in Florida when David Ledbetter was coaching them for about a year, all of this stuff. So $16 million plus interest, and it's going to court.
The reason I wanted to mention, Joe, was a lot of the South American golfers previous to this, Cabrera was one of them. He had won the Masters. He bought himself out of his contract before he had won the Masters. And he isn't the only one that has been funded by these kind of syndicates in South America who support young golfers coming through. But in return, they want their pound of flesh.
Okay.
And here is one just coming to the headlights now, where this has happened many, many times before.
Yeah.
Where they're supporting maybe 10, 20 pros out on tour, where they might hit the jackpot once.
Right. I didn't realize that was the thing that went on. Okay,
yeah.
We'll see how that ends up in court. Fellas, we're pretty much done. Peter, as ever, out at Spawell, thanks so much, pleasure.
Thanks, Joe.
And Gary Murphy, working hard out at the K Club. We must get out and play around soon, hopefully before.
Definitely.
Level 5 comes anywhere near us. Gary, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.
That was Golf Weekly with thanks to Now TV, where you can stream sport on your terms. We'll be back next week. Talk to you then.
OTV Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Stream the Premier League, Serie A and EFL Championships live on Now TV. Your sport on your terms.